Kei te whakaronga mai koe ki te reo irirangi kotahi. You are listening to Radio R1 News here on 91 FM. Ko Gemma Aho.
Ko Kaya Aho.
Coming up on the show today, we will be talking to Andrew Lessels, President of New Zealand University Student Unions, to discuss the Green Party pairing up with student unions to start an open conversation about student well-being. We're also talking to Jack Brazil from Environmental Justice Otupoti about Ravensdown Phosphate and the Western Sahara.
Earlier in the week, we spoke to Camilla Bellick, Labour MP and member of the Education and Workforce Committee, who has given some insight into the pay transparency briefing that was presented to Parliament in March. We'll also be talking to critic writer Denzel Chung about the critic's investigation into Arise Church Dunedin.
Also, we're talking gender-neutral bathrooms and how they influence the people of Aotearoa. Now, we have Bonnie with the news headlines.
The Radio 1 91 FM news headlines.
Kia ora koutou, this is your R1 News Bulletin. It's 11:03 AM, ko Bonnie Aho. Cabinet is set to announce whether the country will move alert levels today. Minister Chris Hipkins will front a press conference today at 1 PM to announce the decision. New Zealand moved to red alert level at midnight on the 23rd of January this year and has remained at this most restrictive protection framework setting since. 16 new deaths with COVID-19 were reported yesterday, bringing the total fatalities to 516, and more than 11,000 new cases were recorded. Meanwhile, the National and ACT parties have called for the protection framework to be scrapped. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson will receive a fine for illegal gatherings held during lockdown in 2020 and 2021. The Prime Minister held several workplace parties with staff while government restrictions stopped families from visiting at-risk loved ones in a saga that has been called Partygate. The value of the fine is unknown. The fines have renewed calls from the opposition Labour leader Keir Starmer for Boris Johnson to be sacked from the premiership, and other members of Parliament have called for the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister has repeatedly denied any wrongdoings. The iconic Sammy's Theatre had new life injected into it over the weekend when local bands used an unlocked accessway into the disused building to hold a lo-fi gig. The bands, Sunflower Scent, Hot Sauce Club and the Beatniks, played to a small but passionate crowd of students, and an anonymous rep told the Otago Daily Times that with flat parties threatened by noise complaints and local venues prohibitively small or expensive, they had to take matters into their own hands. The council has been canvassing options for a new mid-sized performance venue for their 10-year plan and are currently at the consultation stage. That's the news. Now for weather.
The Radio 1 91 FM weather.
I tēnei rā in Otupoti, we have a high of 15 degrees and a low of 7 overnight, getting a bit chilly with a few southwesterlies dying out around midday today. Apōpō Thursday, we have a high of 18 degrees, a little bit warmer, some more sun peeking through in the afternoon, and an overnight low of 10 degrees. And that's your weather.
On Tuesday, it was announced that the Green Party would be joining with student unions to help facilitate a people's inquiry about student well-being. The collaboration involves 33 student unions, and one of the groups leading it is the New Zealand Student Union, the New Zealand University Student Union, NZUSA. NZUSA has a Whirinanga Rō framework, which involves whakaparaki, strengthening student voices, whakawhāunga ngotanga, building connections with others, akaranga, learning with and from each other, and mahi tahi, working together. Joining us now on air is Andrew Lessels, President of NZUSA. Hi Andrew, how are you?
Kia ora, Gemma. Very well, thank you.
So, how is this student wellbeing inquiry different from the student accommodation inquiry of last year?
I think that the inquiry that we're launching now is bigger and it is more broad. We know that students throughout the COVID-19 pandemic have experienced real hardship. COVID has exposed some real inequities in our system. And the accommodation inquiry was really based on some harrowing experiences over the first lockdown. But we've realised that no one has really dug into the hardship the students have experienced for the past few years as the allowances they get become smaller and smaller and the rent they pay becomes larger and larger. We saw a gap and the government wasn't interested in investigating it, so we decided to do it ourselves.
Yeah. Students are not often at the forefront of government policy, and this is quite rare. So what has the process been like putting this whole collaboration together?
We're really keen in this whole process to get the voice of students on the ground. We want them front and centre. So that's why we partnered with about 33 student associations from across the country. We partnered with the Greens because they were actually willing to listen and willing to acknowledge, importantly, that the status quo for student support is broken, and we need to actually start hearing from the voices that matter. So for us, that's been the main driving force throughout creating this inquiry, really giving us a decent data set to advocate for meaningful change, because our students' voices matter and we need someone to listen to them.
Yeah. Is it unusual for a bunch of student unions to collaborate in a way like this?
I think this is the third time in our history that we've had a collaboration this large. Last year and in 2020, we launched a few national student action plans on COVID-19, asking for some really targeted support for students, things like introducing a universal education income, a universal student allowance to help people make ends meet. But for an inquiry this broad, this is the largest group that we've ever had come together, which is really, really awesome.
Yeah, it is. You've said recently that the government is disconnected from the lives of our students across Aotearoa. Could you expand on this and what you mean about it?
I think that the government has really lost touch with the lives of students. We have a government that on one hand talks about all these great things like learners at the centre of their education and creating a barrier-free education system and increasing the number of diverse learners we have across our education sector. And that's really good talk and really good conversation, but they're not backing it up with funding. They're not backing it up with systems that work. And you know, when they talk about a barrier-free education system as one of the main planks of their education policy, and students are having to choose between having lunch and keeping a roof over their head by paying rent, they're really not creating a barrier-free system. So we think there's a real disconnect between what the government is saying and what it's doing. It's talking the talk about making education more accessible while pricing students out day by day as their costs increase and allowances become less and less accessible.
So this is a people's inquiry. I was wondering if you could explain what a people's inquiry is and how it's different from a government inquiry or hard policy.
So the people's inquiry, really, the reason we went with the phrase the people's inquiry is because for us, at front and centre needs to be the voice of students, and that's why we've launched it with the collaboration of 33 associations. And that's really what people's inquiry means to us. Actually, the people who are experiencing this, the people who are living this, the people who are going through this severe hardship day by day are actually the people involved in leading this campaign as well. The Select Committee inquiry into student accommodation was a really great thing, but it, as all parliamentary efforts are, it was disconnected from the lives of students. And we thought that a people's inquiry is something we need to do to be able to hear those voices without it being filtered through a government lens of what sounds best, or without it being filtered through a lens of what sounds palatable and what can we and can't we acknowledge, and really, really capture those voices in an unfiltered way.
Is it possible that we could see any law change coming from this?
We're really hopeful. I think every student in Aotearoa knows the hardship that we're going through. We've got a student allowance that parental income thresholds kick in at $58,000. If you have two parents on minimum wage, you're barely eligible for $100 in the allowance. We know the system is broken. And what the inquiry is really intending to do is get us the meaningful data and the meaningful voices from students to prove that the system is broken. And the government is quite happily at the moment cupping its hands over its ears and going la, 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 pretending that the issue doesn't exist. But our hope with the inquiry is we can get the data and paint such, unfortunately, a bleak picture, because that's the reality, that the government is forced into action, that the government is forced to acknowledge the system needs to change, and tinkering around the edges doesn't do it.
You're going to need a lot of responses to make this inquiry work. How are you planning to reach students with this inquiry?
So we're planning to reach out across the student movement. So all of our local associations are pushing this out in their student community and will be for the foreseeable future. And we're pushing it out across every platform we had. We're going to be doing targeted engagement on particular student issues, so things like international students and the particular hardships they experience, Māori learners, Pacifica learners, disabled learners, the hardships they experience in the space, to make sure those students come forward and share their stories. But we are really tracking well with the inquiry, and we're close to halfway towards our target already. So we've had such engagement from students that we're actually looking at upping the target number of responses, because we really, unsettled a hornet's nest here of hardship, and students are really, really feeding into this, which is fantastic to see and fantastic to have their voices being heard.
Yeah. Obviously, this inquiry serves to benefit students. And students that want to get involved further or perhaps help share it, what is the best way for them to do that?
I think completing the survey and getting every student you know to complete the survey is really powerful. Alongside that, sharing it on all your social media platforms, making sure that when you're engaging with others, you're talking about it. And if you're in an institution that has a strong student association, reaching out to the association and seeing how you can help, seeing how you can engage with students on the ground to fill out the survey as they're walking between classes, as they've got a break between lectures. Figuring out how we can get as many students as possible to fill this out is a really important thing.
Do you have any particular hopes or goals that you're hoping will result from this inquiry at all?
I think our big goal for the last couple of years has been for a universal education income, for a universal student allowance that helps every student to afford to live, regardless of how much they earn, regardless of how much their parents earn, regardless of their personal circumstance or how old they are or where they're studying. Students deserve to be able to live. As it stands, students are the only group in society that are forced to borrow to survive. And the government saying, here's $25 an extra in allowance that won't even cover rent, or here's an extra $25 in living costs on your student loan so you can get more debt to survive, isn't really the answer. So I think a universal system for student support that works for everyone, it shouldn't be a bold ask, it should be the obvious, because we need students and we need education to be able to be the future Aotearoa we want to be. But that's our real hope from this inquiry, is actually getting away from this callous, dehumanising, patronising means testing and towards a system that works for everyone.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Andrew.
Kia ora, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Now we have TJ Shand with Little Sieve.
That track was TJ Shand with Little Sith, and before that we had Andrew Lessels, President of NZUSA, on the line. Fair and transparent pay has been a talking point in the halls of Parliament this last month. Pay transparency would require certain businesses and companies to publish their pay data for the public, with the hope that self-report could have a positive influence on the pay gaps we have in Aotearoa. Last week, Gemma spoke to Camilla Beelidge, Labour MP and member of the Education and Workforce Committee, about pay transparency briefing that was presented to Parliament.
Kia ora, Camilla. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. It's really lovely to be here.
So, as a member of the Education and Workforce Committee, it's really great that we were able to get you for this. What do you think prompted this movement to promote pay transparency?
I think pay transparency has been something that's been talked about within feminist movements and in certain communities for quite a long time. And that's because New Zealand's one of the few countries that doesn't have a pay transparency regime. So I think that a lot of advocates who were looking to decrease the gender pay gap, which we know has remained stubbornly around 10% despite lots of work in this area, have always looked at pay transparency as a possibly another tool towards closing the gender pay gaps. And obviously also a really important element of it is also looking at those pay gaps between different ethnicities as well and looking to close those gaps too.
Yeah, and I was wondering, why do you think that's important now? I know that some almost similar acts and bills have been turned down before.
Yeah, I think under the previous government, there was a members bill, I think, which was not passed. I think that there's been some reservations from some people about making or requiring companies to disclose what has historically been seen as quite private information. But what I would note is that most pay transparency regimes aren't interested in identifying individuals. We've got different tools to use for identifying when there might be, say, an equal pay claim, and the Equal Pay Act addresses issues when people maybe have a colleague who's a different gender and they're doing the same job and they might be paid more, and it provides an ability to raise that as a legal claim. But pay transparency is really looking at the overall situation within an organisation or a company. It's looking at kind of the themes in pay. It's not necessarily looking at individuals' pay. So hopefully people don't need to be too worried about any privacy concerns.
Mind the Gap, the New Zealand organisation, they stated in a policy recommendation that they put forward last year that reducing income inequality boosts economic growth. Do you have any insight on the statement or anything to add?
Yeah, I think Mind the Gap, they've been doing a really impressive campaign in the community for raising awareness around pay transparency issues and promoting the ideas around pay transparency. But I do agree, I think it is likely that if we did have reduced income inequality, that would boost economic growth. I mean, at a really basic level, what we're looking at is raising the incomes of women, Pacifica women, Māori women. If people on high incomes are likely especially if they're on low incomes, to start with, spend their additional money and contribute to economic growth. So I think that there is a clear link there.
How will this pay transparency model fit into current legislation that we have around equal pay and that kind of thing?
Well, the status of the proposals that we have in New Zealand at the moment is, as some of your listeners may be aware, the Education and Workforce Committee, which I'm a member of, recently did a briefing into pay transparency and made some recommendations moving forward. We haven't received a response from the government, who are the decision makers on this issue, around what their proposal will be. So it might be that they recommend that this is looked into further. I think that's probably likely because it's a significant area of policy. It's not a simple issue to solve, and it's not something that wouldn't require a lot of thinking beforehand. So it might be that they suggest more work. I'm not sure whether they would ultimately suggest amendment to the Equal Pay Act. That could be a possibility. The other alternative would be, if they did decide to legislate, would be to look at a standalone piece of legislation. So I think it could fit into the Equal Pay Act in the sense that the Equal Pay Act was established really when there were different pay rates openly for men and women. It was totally legal to pay a woman less for the same job than it was to pay a man the same amount, for a higher amount for that job. So in the 1970s, the Equal Pay Act was passed and moved through and changed that, obviously, in New Zealand. And there's been recent amendments to address pay equity, which is when we look at groups of workers who may have suffered gender-based discrimination because they're undertaking women's work. So we've seen people like early childhood teachers, care workers, those type of roles bringing claims under the amended Equal Pay Act. Pay transparency is different in the sense that it's looking to get information from organisations to highlight potential issues within those organisations. And I could see that fitting into the Equal Pay Act, but I could also see that being a separate piece of work as well. And I don't think in practical terms it really matters exactly where it sits. The important thing is, if the government does decide to move through and recommend further measures on pay transparency, that they're measures that are really going to make a difference for people. I think that's the important thing that we should be looking at.
And obviously, pay transparency is now being discussed in media and everything since the briefing. And I've seen some mixed feelings, particularly surrounding the suggestion of putting salaries in job advertisements. Why do you think there's been such a focus on this?
I'm not sure, and I'm interested that's something that you have noticed, that there has been a particular focus on that. I suppose one reason might be because it wasn't necessarily clear that there would be a recommendation on that when the briefing was started, and so it was maybe more of a surprise to people that it was included. So that might be the reason for the additional attention. But this is an unusual concept to be exploring. I know in the United Kingdom, I think that they are currently going to start a trial under their Conservative government to publish salaries in job advertisements. So it's not really a very revolutionary idea. It's more about giving people information about roles. I think a lot of your listeners would be job seekers at some point in their lives if they haven't been already, and sometimes it can be quite difficult to ascertain if it would be a position you'd be interested in, depending on the remuneration, and that might be because it's in a different city. You might not be willing to move if it's pays under a certain amount. So I think that type of information could be quite helpful, but that's just one of the recommendations that the committee has suggested that the government look at.
The pay transparency model is overall a very intersectional model. Will there be an opportunity to work with relevant communities such as Māori and Pacifica peoples to guide the implementation of the model in these communities?
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I think it is important that what is proposed is intersectional and that it looks at the experience of lots of different cultures and how there might be possibly situations where people are statistically more likely to be paid less if they are a woman, and also additionally even less than that if they say a Pacific woman. And I know that our Equal Opportunities Commissioner at the Human Rights Commission has been doing a really amazing campaign on the Pacific pay gap and looking to close that gap, and she's a member of that community and she's really been a leader in looking at that particular issue. And so I do see that there is a role for making sure that, and I think it's integrally important that whatever measures are recommended, that they have the support of the communities that they affect, because I think that's good lawmaking.
So the policy recommendation is sort of based around a reporting model. Do you think that this will be the extent of pay transparency, or do you think that this could be a stepping stone for more policies focusing on pay gaps in the future?
Well, I think the briefing, the response to the briefing and the report that the Educational Workforce Committee did didn't recommend a reporting-only model. I think it recommended a more substantive model, which would look at reporting, but also would look at what happens in terms of enforcement of that reporting, and also positive steps that can be taken to ensure that information is provided. But obviously that's for the government to determine when they consider this. I don't think the pay gap is going away without action to change the situation that we currently have. But that hasn't been our experience in the past, that the pay gap has closed naturally. So I do think that policies looking at how the pay gap could be closed, especially when we do see those really large pay gaps, for example, a Pākehā man and a Pacific woman, they probably do really need policies to address them. Otherwise, our experience in history is that they stubbornly remain. So I would think that hopefully whatever the government puts in or recommends, that they would look at the reporting only, but also a more comprehensive model as well.
This pay transparency model that the government is now looking into is a mandatory model. How does this differ, and is it more influential than a voluntary one, such as the National Party's registry?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that the important thing to remember is that nothing's been really determined at this stage. And so what the committee recommended was, well, what the committee observed is that mandatory pay reporting models are more likely to close gender pay gaps compared with a voluntary one, which was suggested in the minority report by the National Party members. I wouldn't say that was necessarily an idea that I've seen them promoting separately, but I think that they had some reservations around, and this is consistent with their philosophy, requiring organisations to do something that's compulsory in addition to their additional work. So I think it's not a surprise that they prefer a voluntary model, but what the committee observed was that voluntary models are less likely to result in closing of pay gaps.
That was the interview with Camilla Bailich about pay transparency briefing that had been presented to Parliament last month.
Making me drown. Over Some things in life are priceless. For everything else, there's New Zealand On Air, proudly keeping the good ship Radio 1 afloat for another 25 years.
I love to hate you like a pack of cigarettes. I know what I want, I just ain't there yet. My paper tiger, keep your claws to yourself. Ain't fooling no one, so shut your mouth. I told you that night when you're acting like you're on your throne. Spilling my drink, being a prick, not as cool as you think. And I told you last week when I sold you that ounce. My paper tiger, shut your mouth.
Ravensdown, an Aotearoa-based agricultural cooperative company, has services bringing phosphate rock from the Western Sahara and Morocco to provide superphosphate for soil in New Zealand. Ravensdown claims that without phosphate, Aotearoa's economy will take a $10 billion hit annually. For over 40 years, Morocco has occupied the Western Sahara and displaced over 200,000 Sahrawi people living as refugees. Ravensdown claims that they are following UN frameworks for managing resources in the Western Sahara, but with tensions and violence from Morocco rising again in this area, environmental justice Otipoti says it's time for their support to stop. We are now joined by Jack Brazel, member of environmental justice Otipoti. Hi, Jack. How are you?
Gemma. Good, thanks. Yourself?
I'm good, yeah. So how do these shipments from Ravensdown affect the climate crisis?
So what we have here in Otipoti, Dunedin right now at the Port Chalmers, Korpatai, is a huge bulk carrier called the Stony Stream carrying tens of thousands of blood phosphate, which is illegally mined in occupied Western Sahara. So Ravensdown are funding Morocco's brutal military occupation, which has been going on for 45 years so far. So it's related to the climate crisis through industrial agriculture, but we're primarily advocating here for the Sahrawi's right for a UN referendum for self-determination. And so at this stage, Ravensdown and Balanced Agri-Nutrients are one of two companies left in the world independent from Morocco who are still funding this brutal military occupation.
Yeah, and how do Ravensdown's actions impact the displaced people of the Western Sahara?
So what's been happening is OCP, which is the Moroccan state-owned company, which is the largest employer in Western Sahara, has basically formed a relationship with Ravensdown, a commercial relationship, and have either... I don't believe Ravensdown ignorant in this situation, because this is the long history of fertiliser in New Zealand, of extractive industries and destroying indigenous lands. So they've formed this commercial relationship, and they receive all of their information from this company, which has the financial interest in keeping this occupation going. So Ravensdown, when they say they work within UN frameworks, they're actually just listening to the very company and the military who are actually occupying Western Sahara.
Yeah. Do you know of any way for Ravensdown to source phosphate otherwise, or an alternative media that they could use to help soil?
Yes, this is the awful thing, really, is that we have it on very good authority that Ravensdown is able to source the superphosphate rock from alternate sources, but it would require them to upgrade their factories. They have five factories across Aotearoa, so, and we've estimated that that's about $2 million per factory. And so given that they posted about a $59 million profit for 2021 alone, we can't really see how $10 million is an actual barrier in ensuring that they're not funding an ongoing war. And I say ongoing war because this has displaced around 200,000 Sahrawi refugees into refugee camps in Tindouf, Algeria. And just in the last year and a half, Morocco broke a 30-year-long ceasefire and has since been engaging in open war against Sahrawi peoples, oppressing activists. These are heinous war crimes, I'm sure you can imagine, as we're seeing play out across Ukraine right now. And we've got players like the United States who are selling them weapon drone systems since Trump formally recognised Morocco's annexation, occupation, before he went out of office, and the Biden administration quietly kept that. So, yeah, it's a pretty horrendous situation at the moment. And if you look up on Democracy Now, who have been following this, they've recently just interviewed Sultana Haya, who has been under almost a 500-day police siege and against her and her sisters and mothers, undergoing some pretty horrific violence.
What ultimately would environmental justice or Tupoti like to see done about this, and is there any way that the community can support them?
Yeah, that's a great question. Ultimately, we, as we've been calling on Ravensdown for multiple years, is to source phosphate from another place immediately, which we know is possible. We know that this their continued purchase of this phosphate is what hinges Morocco's ongoing occupation and is what is preventing Sahrawi people from having their self-determined referenda. And this is all guaranteed under international law. So we would like for that support to be shown to the Sahrawi people. We're pretty disappointed in the New Zealand government so far for failing to recognise Western Sahara as a sovereign state. You know, they are part of the African Union, one of 80 states there, and so we're one of few countries in the world that actually doesn't recognise that and plays along next to sort of imperial warring interests. We had Jacinda Ardern visit these camps in 2008 when she was the president of the Young Socialists, and so it's been pretty disappointing that since she's been in power for 5 years, we've heard nothing from her, given that this is a situation comparable to Ukraine. So we would like New Zealand politicians to actually regulate and sanction against this phosphate import, as South Africa did in 2018 in their High Court or Supreme Court. They seized the phosphate ship, recognising it as stolen goods, and actually returned the money to the Sahrawi people. So we would like for that to happen, and we would like if people, as the Sahrawi peoples have been calling for, to basically just remember them, to know them, to share their stories, to have these conversations, to raise awareness. The Sahrawi culture is a very beautiful oratory culture of music, poems and songs. that's how they have continued their resistance, their peaceful resistance. So if people are able to support that, if they're able to write their MPs, to write their fertiliser companies, just to support the Western Sahara Campaign New Zealand and Environmental Justice Aotearoa, you can follow them to stay up to date with information and ways to help. But basically, we've done direct action against Ravensdown before, shutting down their factories, and we will do it again if politicians fail to act. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jack.
Thank you. Thank you very much for hearing this out, and especially while the ship's in the harbour in Aotearoa right now.
Yeah. Awesome. Now we hand over to Kaya, who is going to talk about gender-neutral bathrooms in New Zealand.
In Aotearoa, gender identity is becoming an increasingly discussed and understood concept. This evolution has supported a push for gender-diverse needs to be met in workplaces, schools and communities. Earlier this week, I spoke to Maggie and Asher from Gender Neutral Bathrooms New Zealand about gendered bathrooms in schools, the problems these cause and what the government can do to help.
Since the beginning of 2020, a group of young people in Aotearoa have been campaigning for changes around the gendering of bathrooms in schools. The students originally sought to increase the number of gender-neutral bathrooms at their own school, Tamaki Makaurau's Albany Senior High School. While the students were successful in their original goal, they have decided to implement their project on a larger scale, hoping to make an impact across the country. I spoke to Maggie and Asher from Gender Neutral Bathrooms NZ about the importance and difficulties of accessing gender-neutral bathrooms in schools. Kia ora Maggie, kia ora Asher.
Hello, good morning.
Gender-neutral bathrooms NZ formed a couple of years ago, but your group is still pushing for change both at your school and on a governmental level. Why do you believe there's such a strong need for gender-inclusive bathrooms in schools?
It's so important that the needs of students that don't align with their birth sex are met, and to feel like they have to force themselves into one of those two boxes just to feel safe or comfortable in the bathroom should not have to happen and is definitely avoidable.
As you say, Maggie, this is an avoidable issue. However, the majority of schools in Aotearoa don't provide gender-neutral bathrooms to their students. Even at Albany Senior High School, the only bathroom options for gender-diverse students are the disabled and staff toilets. Asher, would you feel comfortable describing your experiences of the limited bathrooms available to gender-diverse students?
So, I am non-binary myself. I came out about 3 years ago and started openly presenting as non-binary when I moved to the school. And one of the things that I found is, despite having a really open and inclusive school environment where I felt safe, there was always an issue when it came to bathrooms. Like, the closest thing to non-gender bathrooms is the disabled bathroom down by the nurse's office or the staff bathrooms. So, as a non-binary student, I went out of my way to avoid using bathrooms. So I would drink less water during the day, try and avoid anything that could make me need to go to the bathroom, because I didn't want to personally put myself in a situation where I had to misgender myself or make myself feel unsafe or uncomfortable in a bathroom that didn't align with my gender.
Thanks for that, Asher. You described using gendered bathrooms as misgendering yourself and mentioned that you sometimes feel unsafe or uncomfortable in bathrooms that don't align with your gender. For people who have not experienced or witnessed the harm of gender-exclusive bathrooms, this might be a controversial statement. Why does your group think there's a need for gender-neutral bathrooms as opposed to gender-diverse students using disabled bathrooms?
When a gender-diverse student is forced to use a bathroom that doesn't correspond with their gender or is a different gender to what they identify as, it can cause a lot of dysphoria, mental health issues. It can cause them to be very uncomfortable. And this also isn't a disability and should not be treated like one.
As you described, Maggie, there are plenty of arguments for ensuring schools have gender-neutral bathrooms, but there are also reasons to keep some bathrooms gendered. Many people may feel uncomfortable sharing a bathroom with the opposite sex. Would you prefer to see all school bathrooms as gender-neutral, or does your group see a need to keep some bathrooms gendered?
Yeah, we would never want to have schools change their bathrooms to be all gender neutral, because we can empathize with people that might have fears about people of the opposite sex using the same bathroom spaces as them. And so we would always, like, we would hope schools would always have single-sex bathroom options and then also have accessible gender-neutral options for students.
Maggie, you've mentioned you'd hope all schools would have both gender-neutral bathrooms and gendered bathrooms. What started as a project to increase gender-neutral bathrooms at your school has become a campaign to change the way schools approach the concept of gendered bathrooms nationwide. What's the end goal of your campaign now?
Our end goal of our project is that the Ministry of Education will have provided specific funding for all schools in Aotearoa to have constructed gender-neutral bathrooms. At the moment, schools get a certain budget that they're allowed to spend on, like, renovations they need or any construction changes. The budget's not big enough as they are, but a lot of schools are also relying on, like, school donations and other things in order to renovate certain things they need in their school and make changes. And it also means, like, a lot of schools that maybe don't have the same values as our school wouldn't see gender-neutral bathrooms as a necessity. And so, like, we think not only schools should be provided extra funding, but it should be a requirement.
What steps do you want to see from the government right now to ensure that these goals are met as quickly and effectively as possible?
We think sticking to the promises that they actually made during their 2020 election campaign, one of which being that they will provide schools with gender-neutral bathrooms.
The Ministry of Education defined a specific set of priorities in the 2020 Education and Training Act. This document is called the Statement of National Education and Learning Priorities, or NELP. Do you feel that the current lack of gender-neutral bathrooms in Aotearoa schools is in contradiction with the priorities described in NELP?
States that schools need to create a safe and inclusive culture where diversity is valid and all learners and staff, including those who identify as LGBTQIA+, are disabled, have learning support, are neurodivergent, or from diverse ethnic communities, feel they belong. So we believe that currently our Ministry of Education is not letting schools meet these standards because our gender diverse students do not feel comfortable at our schools, and we need to make sure that this change is happening so that we can meet these standards that the ministry created themselves.
Your group has been working closely with Albany Senior High School as they increase gender-neutral bathrooms on campus. How has this process influenced your assertion that schools need specific funding for these gender-inclusive facilities?
It currently is going to cost our school roughly $60,000 to renovate our bathrooms at our school. Or very little of this budget can be covered through our school's capital budget, which is every 5 years you get money to do general maintenance. And most of that money normally gets taken up by that general maintenance or other projects. So even there's like no way a smaller school or a lower decile school would ever be able to make up this money from its community to invest in this project, which is why it's so important to get the ministry to fund these projects.
Now, Maggie and Asha, thank you for talking to me about your campaign and experiences.
That was Maggie and Asha from Gender Neutral Bathrooms New Zealand discussing gendered bathrooms in schools and communities. Coming up now, we have an interview with critic-editor Denzel Chung from Arise Church. Arise Church has been prominent in the media over the past fortnight, following allegations against the church made by ex-members, including Otago University students. Critic Te Arohi has been covering these allegations and was recently contacted by Arise Church's PR representative regarding their articles. Earlier today, I spoke to Critic News editor and author of the Arise Church expose, Denzel Chung, about the articles and the events surrounding them.
Over the past week, Critic has written two articles relating to recent allegations against Arise Church, a multi-million dollar megachurch in Aotearoa. As the writer behind these articles, could you please describe some of the recent allegations made against Arise Church?
So the recent allegations were, I guess, detailed first by David Farrier on his blog Webworm, and basically they involved the internship program which they'd run, and reports of interns being overworked, and actually being not even just not being paid, but also having to pay to do their internship with Arise Church. And there were also, we found interestingly, there were some allegations specific to the Dunedin-based church as well. In particular, there was one who said there was a culture of interns being made to do personal work for the staff, things like babysitting them or driving their kids around, and as well as that, asking students to pay their course-related costs to go to their conferences.
Arise Church was initially called out, as you say, by journalist David Farrier, who has been posting on his blog and tweeting allegations against the church. How does Critic fit into this situation?
Well, at first we started reporting on the story primarily because of the Dunedin angle, and Arise is a very student-heavy church. There are most of their congregation is under 35, so we thought it would be of interest to re-report those allegations, since no other media was really covering that at the time. So that's how we started getting involved in this.
Critic has posted two stories on Arise Church this week. The first describes statements made by an Otago University student about their negative experiences in the church, and the follow-up, published April 10th, reveals that your office was contacted by Arise Church's PR representative just hours after Critic posted the initial article. Why do you think Arise engaged a PR representative instead of one of their leaders answering?
If I'm speculating, I guess it's the same reason why a lot of other large organizations engage PR representatives, because they're conscious of their image, because they want to do damage control, and they want to do it in a way which minimizes, I guess, the impact it has on their reputation. And I guess it's still, for us in Critic, it's very much an open question as to why they responded so suddenly after having basically ghosted much more bona fide journalist than we are, for over a week and a half.
Would you say it's usual for churches at a nationwide level to have a PR representative?
Well, for the vast majority of churches, I don't think it's normal. The vast majority of churches are reasonably small and usually quite cash-strapped. They struggle to pay more than a handful of full-time staff, never mind a PR agency. But I guess for larger, what's termed mega churches like Arise, they're very much in the spotlight, so I guess they see things a little bit differently.
As you say, Arise Church is quite prominent in the media at the moment due to an investigation by journalist David Farrier of myriad allegations against the church. He's been trying to get a response from Arise for over a week with no luck, and so he published a series of tweets calling the church out for not responding. Eventually, he received a reply from Kingdom PR on April 10th. In contrast, Critic received an email from Arise's PR on April 9th, the same day your article was posted. Why do you think the church felt a more urgent need to respond to Critic than to David Farrier?
The way Kingdom PR explained it to us was that our media inquiry came in asking them about the situation, and they were actually unaware of David Farrier emailing Arise, because according to Kingdom PR, they'd only been engaged by Arise a couple of days before we'd actually reached out to them. So kind of as, I guess, they got wind that the story was about to be published. So, it was only a couple of hours actually after I emailed Kingdom PR asking them, why haven't you responded to David Farrier, that they said, oh, we didn't know David Farrier had actually emailed. And within a couple of hours of that, he got that email in his inbox, so yeah, that was quite interesting.
Stories about religion and politics are always going to engender strong feelings from readers. As you say in your article, there's a large following of Arise Church among Otago students. Has Critic received any feedback or comment from Otago University students since posting the articles?
We've received, from what I know, this is mainly from Elliot, who is in charge of the story, and from Fox, our chief editor. We've received a couple of emails, but not really from current Arise members, as far as I know. They've actually been from mainly ex-members who have been reaching out to tell us about their experiences with Arise. And so, yeah, actually, from what I know anyway, we haven't really got much in the way of negative blowback quite yet.
Arise Church contends that the allegations against them have been investigated internally and practices have changed, especially considering you've heard from ex-Arise students at the university. Do you intend to do a follow-up piece to see if Arise's statement rings true for students involved in Arise's Otago community?
I think this is a story that we'd like to keep investigating, especially with the perspectives of students, because I think that's important. Obviously, it's a good sign that they've publicly, said we admit this culture is wrong and we'll start an investigation and we want to try and engender a culture change. But I think, it's only really the people on the ground who can actually tell us whether that culture has actually changed or whether it will actually change. So, yeah, I mean, Arise is a big church and they're a very big, and being a very student-focused church, I think this is something that we'd obviously like to keep looking at.
Thank you so much.
That's right.
That was Critic news editor Denzel Chung talking about Arise Church and the expose that came out in The Critic. This has been R1 News for Ra'apa, 13th of April. Today we talked to Andrew Lessels, president of NZUSA, about Greens Party joining with student unions to talk about student wellbeing. We talked to Camilla Bailich, Labour MP and member of the Education and Workforce Committee, about the pay transparency briefing presented to Parliament. We talked to Jack Brazel, member of Environmental Justice Otupoti, about Ravensdown and phosphate from the Western Sahara. And we had a discussion with members of Albany Senior High School about gender-neutral bathrooms. Thank you. Keep on listening to Radio 1, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.